there's an existing incumbent nearby and they claim that area, then they can say, no, you can't fund that, we'll challenge it. And then they don't really have to give you a time frame as to when they are going to provide that service. So it's a real showstopper.
This is episode 267 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm Lisa Gonzalez. This week, Michael Anderson from Spiral Internet and Christopher talk about the California company, their history, and their approach. They also discuss what it's like to work in an environment where national providers do all they can to prevent competition from ISPs like Spiral. Some of those efforts are playing out right now as the state legislature reviews funding that has traditionally been used to expand internet access in rural areas. Before we start the interview, we want to remind you that this commercial-free conversation is not free to produce. Please take a moment to contribute at ilsr.org. If you've already contributed, thanks. Now here's Christopher and Michael Anderson from Spiral Internet.
Welcome to another edition of the Community Broadband Bits podcast. I'm Chris Mitchell with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance up here in Minneapolis. Today I'm talking with Michael Anderson, the Chief Information Officer for Spiral Internet, all the way out there in California. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you, Chris.
So you are in California, but in a place called Nevada City, I believe, which confuses me every single time I talk to you or one of your folks from Spiral Internet. Can you tell us a little bit about more about your company?
Whenever you hear Nevada City, California, people still think that we are in the state of Nevada, which is not the case. Actually, Nevada City had the name Nevada first, and then when the state came along, they added the city. That was back in the 1850s. So anyways, Nevada City is a gold rush town located halfway between Lake Tahoe and Sacramento. And we're off the I-80 a little bit north of there. Interestingly enough, it's a technology hub, starting with the mining technology going back into the 1850s. And now after World War II, a gentleman by the name of Linton came up here and did glass tubes for technology after the war effort. And then the Grass Valley Group is based here, which is a video equipment manufacturer. And they've had spinoffs since the 1960s. So we call ourselves Video Valley, and we've got about 150 technology companies here, though our population is just about 100,000.
And you're not an incumbent provider, right? You are a company that has sort of sprung up to fill in gaps and seize an opportunity to actually provide good service compared to the incumbents.
Well, that's correct. Yeah, so back in the 90s, AT&T was the incumbent, and they had dial-up and then introduced DSL, and then Comcast came in. We have two cities here that are side by side, about 3 miles apart, Grass Valley and Nevada City. And there were a number of DSL resellers, Spiral being one of them, that competed with AT&T in the 2000s. And so that's our history. We've been around actually since the mid-90s when we first offered dial-up to compete with AT&T and other dial-up providers. But so around 2010, realized that Comcast was pretty much done with their build and they had stuck to the city centers. And AT&T was starting to not expand with the DSL anymore. And we realized that it was time to start thinking about fiber. So that's when our CEO, John Paul, and his partner, Chip Carmen, started going to some conferences and understanding and learning about what was happening with fiber out in the rest of the country, and decided to do a proposal for a fiber project through the California Public Utilities Commission, California Advanced Services Fund.
It's interesting because I've met John Paul a few times at Broadband Communities, and I just wanted to throw in a quick plug for people who are not aware, but there's a Broadband Communities event up in Atlanta coming down in November. It's the second week, I believe, of November. And it's if people go to bbcmag.com/Atlanta, you'll find information about it. So just wanted to slide that in there. And it's been great. I actually feel kind of bad because I've talked to John Paul like for many years. And then I met you one time and I was like, come on my show. So Well, one of the things that I found interesting is that there's certainly private companies and municipalities that I think of as seeing their role as kind of doing what Comcast does, but doing it with better technology, more reasonable pricing, good customer service. But they haven't really changed the business model in interesting ways necessarily, aside from those things which are clearly valued by subscribers. You guys have a different philosophy, I think.
Yeah, we do, because through the educational process that we've undergone and understanding how things are being done in Asia and Europe through what's known as open access, where you know the fiber or whatever other wireline technology is a utility, and then the retail services are on top of that, and the competition for those retail services really drives the price down and provides a lot of granularity for customers as to what kind of services they want, whether it's phone or data or video content. Whereas, you know, here with proprietary networks in the United States, people are stuck with bundles. So we're not doing a bundle. We will be providing just the internet and then helping our customers figure out how they want to do their retail services. And, you know, hopefully in the future, the United States will become more of a open access country, and the proprietary networks will start to diminish.
Does that mean then that you're open to, if some of the counties around you or communities wanted to build just the infrastructure and lease it to you to operate on, that you would be open to that?
Absolutely. And we've been actually talking to a number of communities in Northern California yesterday, talking with our CFO, and he was curious. So how many, you know, communities are we actually talking about? And there's 22 of them that are currently, you know, unserved or underserved. They have DSL that's starting to fall through the cracks, and the incumbent, whether it's Comcast or Suddenlink or Charter or whoever else, that they're really kind of stuck in a very tight footprint and not willing to move out of a, you know, dense city center. So the surrounding areas in those 22 communities are just really hurting, and they're all starting to show up at these conferences and trying to figure out, well, you know, what is our option? So they're looking at muni builds, and they're looking at ways to get things kind of kickstarted, but they're not really interested in running the actual ISP or, you know, finding those retail services. So we're trying to figure out ways to help them do that. So yeah, we're in discussions with a number of communities in Northern California. That's sort of what we see as our footprint in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years.
And I think just as a reminder, you say Northern California. It's funny because I always think of it as Eastern California. I'm not being all that savvy with how people think of it. But to be clear, this is not the Redwood Coast area. This is more in the mountains and things like that, right?
Well, actually, yeah, people have different ideas out there as to what Northern California really is. I mean, California is an enormous place, and a lot of people think, oh, Northern California, you're talking about San Francisco.
Well, I always get a kick out of that, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're really not looking at San Francisco. We're looking at everything north of San Francisco. And so if you were to draw a line through Marin County all the way to the state of Nevada, say Reno, everything north of that all the way to the Oregon border is the territory that we're looking at. So Nevada County, Nevada City, Grass Valley, that's in that area. And Sacramento is there. They have, of course, a number of incumbents. But surprisingly enough, a big city like Sacramento, the capital of the state of California, the more suburban and even rural areas just outside of the Sacramento city footprint are also having a tremendous amount of difficulty getting good broadband in those areas.
Sure. I wish that was a surprise, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So one of the things that California has done to try and remedy that, and you mentioned that you've been a recipient of a grant from this process, but the California Public Utilities Commission, which is often called the CPUC, they have a program that is open to all, really, I believe, although it's mostly smaller companies such as yourself that have taken advantage of it, where they offer a grant program to try and improve internet access in specific communities. And Before we get into how some of the providers or some of the big companies like AT&T are trying to change it, maybe you can just describe how the process works for the rounds that you've been involved in.
I guess around 2010, a former commissioner on the Public Utilities Commission had really noticed that this underserved and under an unserved area issue was starting to come to a head. So she was able to, her name is Rochelle Chong, and she was able to lobby the current commissioners to create this fund called the California Advanced Services Fund under the CPUC. And that allowed any provider, it could be Comcast or AT&T, but it was mostly designed for smaller companies like Spiral to apply for funds to help these rural areas get connected with a faster version of broadband.
How is it funded?
Okay, so it's funded through a small tax that's on everybody's landline bill in the state of California. I think it's about 14 cents, and it's there every month for just the, you know, copper landline connection. And it translates to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over, you know, 2 or 3 years time frame. And so what happens is that I believe the first funding was in 2011, and then there was one in 2014. And then now there's a new one that's coming along. But what happens is that the money gets put into the fund, and then the fund is drawn down by applications. And then once it gets to a point where it needs to be replenished, then it goes to the legislature again. And then they go through the process of reviewing the program and agreeing to continue having that tax on all the landline bills.
And this is something that even some of the bigger carriers themselves have taken part of. I think Frontier, I've seen their name pop up sometimes. So this isn't just a program for smaller companies like you. It's really available and been used by large companies as well, right?
That is correct. I believe Frontier has taken advantage of it. And, of course, Frontier took over the Verizon region that they had previously had in California. Up until now, the companies like Comcast and Suddenlink and Charter and AT&T had not taken advantage of the fund. In fact, they made it pretty clear that they were interested and they supported the program and were just neutral on how they felt about what was going on with this.
Right. Although, as we're about to learn, that didn't last. Suddenly, something's different. And this is something that I've railed on before, but it sounds like there's an effort to kind of poison it and an effort from the big companies to protect their turf in ways that will make the program really less valuable overall, unfortunately.
That seems to be what's happening. So the current assembly bill is AB 1665. And they were hoping to be able to vote on it in the current session, but they had to table it because of this increased interest on the part of AT&T and Comcast. Their lobbyists started to really get involved in the process. And I do want to mention on a side note that rural broadband is a bipartisan issue. So many of the assembly members who are on this legislation are Republicans in very conservative rural districts, and they're co-sponsors and have, after some education, have really come on board with the concept of getting this money and having it go to whoever's willing to put a project in place in their areas, because, you know, most of these areas are agricultural, and you know, you really can't compete in the agricultural world without a good broadband connection. I mean, that's what's happening, and they see that. And so they're on board, and it's really great to have a bipartisan issue that, you know, conservatives and liberals can get together on and work hard on trying to solve this problem.
And I think it's also worth noting, and I hope you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the kind of thing for people who see the world often as Republican versus Democrat. This is also the case that the AT&T lobbyists spend a lot of time golfing with Democrats and prominent Democrats. I think the LA Times has done a series of stories about just how powerful AT&T is with the Democrats. So this isn't kind of a situation for people who want to be a purist on one side or the other. This is, it's complicated as to how the parties break down in supporting this kind of high quality access when they're faced with a powerful lobbying campaign from AT&T.
That's right. That's right on. And the cities on the coast, LA and San Francisco and San Diego, you know, those are all predominantly Democratic legislatures and legislators, and they really don't have much understanding of the rural broadband problem. They look at what's happened in their cities, and they consider themselves to be very well served by the incumbents. And when the incumbents tell them that the cities in the rural areas are also served in the same manner, they don't really spend a lot of time, you know, in our area. They don't see how people live and where they live. And so, you know, the fact that there's a line where that service stops is a little bit unknown to them. So that's part of the education that we've had to undergo in Sacramento. And we're doing our lobbying and working with the legislators and saying, look, you know, yeah, you've got a nice situation in the city, but out here we have a little bit of a different situation. And come on up and spend some time with us, and we'll show you exactly what we're talking about. And, you know, one of the things that I'd really like to mention is our biggest lobbying group in rural California are the realtors and the people that are now faced with situations where they're trying to sell homes and property that used to be served by DSL and actually are losing service. And we have a number of realtors who've here in Nevada County who have fallen out of escrow because, you know, the home was put in on the market. It had DSL service. And then come to find out after the sale, the DSL was no longer available. And that's just been really kind of crazy.
And to explain the mechanics of that, something that we've seen before is that there may be a limited number of circuits. There's a waiting list to get on it. So when a homeowner is selling their home and they're leaving, they lose service. And then you don't get new service as a new person moving in. You get put on a wait list until other people move out, basically.
Yeah. And here in Nevada County, the wait list, that actually, they don't even do that anymore. There is no wait list. So what we tell the realtors, and this is what they're doing here in Nevada County, is if you're selling your home, you don't turn off your telephone service, your landline service, which has the DSL attached. You leave it in your name and let it go through escrow and then just basically hand that off to the new owner under the name of the previous owner. And then you wait a year or whatever and then put your name on it as another person on that landline.
If there's not a waiting list, why are they turning circuits off? I mean, is it still a shortage? I mean, do they have fewer DSL circuits today than they did 6 months ago?
Yeah, and that's just anecdotal. I don't know exactly how that's all set up. But, you know, as a DSL provider, Spiral, we know that there's less DSL service in the areas that we resell over those copper lines than we had before because they are decreasing the number of connections. And I think that's just part of the strategy that AT&T has with their wireless. You know, they're moving to a wireless business model. They have a Connected America Fund grant that they're using in rural California. I think it's $60 million that they're putting up cell towers, and they'll have 5G as well as fixed wireless on those towers.
Yeah. I believe it when I see it. I'm trying to calm down over here as you're describing that, because we've been following what AT&T is doing. And at least in the Southeast and in a lot of other places, it seems like they're just planning on doing a straight 10 megabit by 1 megabit, cashing all that money from the federal government and then saying, why would we ever upgrade? You know, if you want us to upgrade, you can throw $1 billion at us again. So I want to get back, though, rather than talking about the sad plight of folks and talk more about the solutions. But before we get there, the thing that we were dancing around and the thing that AT&T and some of the cable companies are trying to do is this basically a right of first refusal. And so if you can just tell me exactly how this works and what the concern is in Sacramento over this proposed change to the CPUC broadband funds.
There's a couple of things that they've added to this recent legislation, AB 1665. poison pill is probably a bit harsh, but anyways, it's a way of making it so that less people will have access to this funding. And one of those is they've added this this one line: the commission shall award grants from the broadband infrastructure grant account on a technology neutral basis, including both wireline and wireless technology. Now that's new, because before, when we received our grant in December of 2015, the commissioners were very clear that the wireless technology, fixed wireless technology, really wasn't going to be robust enough moving forward. And those were the challengers that had challenged our grant. And you know, it's one of the reasons it took 2 years for after our application to be approved, is that we had to go through these wireless challengers. And these were fixed wireless providers in our region, smaller companies. And so we were able to prove that they didn't have the coverage that they said that they did. So adding that back in there, where the commissioners had in our resolution approving our grant proposal, they had said that wireless needed to be looked at as a legacy technology. So that's one thing. The other one is the one you just talked about, in terms of if an existing incumbent is going to be providing service. The actual language here is: the commission shall annually offer an existing facility-based provider the opportunity to demonstrate that it will provide broadband access to a delineated unserved area within a reasonable time frame. The commission shall not approve funding for a project providing broadband access to a delineated unserved area if the existing facility-based provider demonstrates to the commission that it will, within a reasonable time frame, upgrade existing service to provide broadband access throughout the project area. So that's new language. And basically what it's saying is, if there's an existing incumbent nearby and they claim that area, then they can say, no, you can't fund that, we'll challenge it. And then they don't really have to give you a time frame as to when they are going to provide that service. So it's a real showstopper.
Well, and I think maybe you can describe to us how the conversation would go now if you go to a bank or some other investor in a project and they're saying, well, wait, you know, you can put in this application, but at any point you can basically get derailed by the incumbent. That's not something that – it's something that seems like it has a lot more risk suddenly.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So you know, the private funders that we work with, they've expressed concerns with this new language, and we're hoping, again, it's still in committee, and we're hoping that we can get that pulled out. It just got added recently, so you know, it's a back and forth, and we're hoping that people will understand, you know, the ramifications of that language and what it does to really reduce the amount of area in Northern California that will be available for this kind of funding.
Well, especially when you just consider that there's so much freedom of the incumbent then basically to just circle all of the areas that have higher density, higher marginal profit potential, and just deny a business case to anyone to connect the other areas as well. And then those areas are just totally left behind. I mean, this sort of language, just, I find it infuriating, because I understand if someone hears constantly from the cable lobbyists, from AT&T, oh, we have to do it this way. But like, you need to run this by someone critically and say, hey, if this is what we're trying to achieve, if we're trying to say we don't want to, for the state to create unfair competition, is this a good way to do it or not? And obviously it's not.
Yeah, I totally agreed. And in fact, I mentioned that we were we had challenges with our project where and the grant that we were given, that the challenges were from fixed wireless companies. But we did have one challenge from Comcast, and it was for a very specific area that they said that they served. And as a matter of fact, they didn't serve that area. So we actually had to go. We had that money pulled out of our grant where it had originally been set up. And then we've had to go house by house and say, are you served? And have them, you know, write basically an affidavit saying, no, I'm not served. And then we're in the process of having re-challenging that and getting that money put back in, which we're very confident is going to happen.
I mean, I don't want to just presume bad faith, but you hear enough of these stories and it's either incompetence or bad faith, and neither one of them should be rewarded by the regulators or the lawmakers. And next week, we're going to be doing a show, if the schedule holds, in which we'll talk more about some of the wireless issues and actually federal grants, and how, you know, if this is money to try and deal with unserved areas, one should not embrace a technology that cannot cover some people. I mean, a lot of these WISPs, even WISPs that are doing a great job, they're using a technology where if you're living on the wrong side of a hill, they can't cover you. And we should be really thinking hard about whether we're going to subsidize technologies that leave some people out.
Right. Exactly. You're right on the money with that.
So with you know, with a nice interview that got increasingly ranty by the host, I really appreciate you. I really appreciate you coming on, and I think you know, giving people a hope also that there's companies out there that get the benefits of open access, and that ideally we can find a way to make sure everyone's covered and has a choice and has high quality connectivity.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you're doing, because I think the key to all of this is education. I mean, that's what we do all day long. There are so many people that, just because they live in the United States and their only experience with broadband, you know, is based on a bundle and a proprietary network, they have no idea what open access is, what it would look like, how it would function. And once you tell them, their eyes open up wide and they just say, wow, how do we get that? So that's what we're hoping to do, is get that education out there and help people understand this is the way for America to be globally competitive. And without adequate broadband, we're really going to be having a difficult time with that.
Right. Well, let's go build some markets then. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the time.
That was Michael Anderson from Spiral Internet visiting with Christopher about the company and how big internet access providers are lobbying to change funding rules in California. We have transcripts for this and other Community Broadband Bits podcasts available at muninetworks.org/broadbandbits. Email us at podcast@muninetworks.org with your ideas for the show. You can follow Chris on Twitter. His handle is @communitynets. You can also follow muninetworks.org stories on Twitter. The handle is @muninetworks. Subscribe to this podcast and the other ILSR podcasts, Building Local Power and the Local Energy Rules podcast. You can access them on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Never miss out on our original research. Subscribe to our monthly newsletter at ILSR.org. Thank you to Arnie Huseby for the song Warm Duck Shuffle, licensed through Creative Commons. And thanks for listening to episode 267 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast.